Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the keynote address from the Nebraska Library Association's 2012 Tri-Conference, held in cooperation with the Mountain Plains Library Association and the Nebraska School Librarians Association. The guest speaker will be Tom Osborne, former head football coach and retiring athletic director at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, as well as former Republican congressman from Nebraska's 3rd District from 2000 to 2006. In recent years, Dr. Osborne and his wife Nancy have founded the Teammates Mentoring Program to provide support and encouragement to school-aged youth. The goal of the program is to see youth graduate from high school and pursue post-secondary education by working with a community mentor. The Teammates Mentoring Program currently provides a mentor for over 5,000 young people across Nebraska, Iowa, and California. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 18, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Nebraska Library Association, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Sally Ganim, the First Lady of the State of Nebraska.
Welcome to each of you for attending today, and I'm sure the conference has been going great. And it sounds wonderful to be able to learn and gather together. I also want to just say thank you to each of you for the work that you do every day in promoting reading and helping our children, our youth of Nebraska, to learn how to read. Now, as a former elementary principal, I say I'm a recovering principal. I've always told the kids at the elementary level, you know, it's really important to read. How else are you going to be able to text your friends when you're in junior high? But it is truly an honor and a privilege to be able to represent Read Aloud Nebraska. And Read Aloud Nebraska annually recognizes individuals, groups, or businesses who have supported Reading Aloud. And this is the 10th year that this award has been given. And we are proud to recognize Dr. Tom Osborne for this year. And he has, you talk about a gentleman being involved in education and promoting reading. He's participated in a poster project of the Nebraska State Reading Council, Go Big Read, with the R and the E and the D in caps in the word read. And as a congressman, he was part of the Get Caught Reading campaign. He also participated in a poster campaign by Read Aloud Nebraska, Nebraskans Proud to Read Aloud. And he's participated in so many, there would be just lists, but he's participated in many, many school activities and functions, events that promote reading throughout the years and throughout Nebraska. So he truly, truly is a Nebraska Read Aloud champion. So at this time, I'd like to have Dr. Tom Osborne come forward because we do have the award to present to you, and it truly is a pleasure to be able to present to you this year's award for 2012.
Thank you so much.
You got to stay up here.
Okay. Thank you.
You deserve that, Coach. I also have the pleasure of introducing to you our keynote speaker for this afternoon, Dr. Tom Osborne.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank Sally very much. She and I crossed paths quite a bit, and I really appreciate all that she's done for education over so many years. And I'm hoping that you can hear me okay. I've got plenty of wires on me now. And so I can imagine what you're sitting there thinking. You know, here I am. I work with books and libraries, and what in the world would a football coach have to say to librarians? And I want you to know that I have read a few books. I've written a few. Most of which none of you have ever read or have any desire to read. But anyway, I appreciate the work that you do very much. And as a coach, sometimes I didn't always work with the greatest students in the world. And I remember this one time we had this guy who was a really good player, but his transcript was not very impressive. And so I took him over to the registrar's office to do the entrance exam, and I talked to the registrar, and I said, you know, maybe we better have the short form for this particular guy. And he said, okay. He said, what's he want to major in? I said, well, he wants to major in agriculture. He said, okay. He said, I think I can handle this. He said, I'll just give him a two-part question. So he said, young man, he said, what's a place where they raise pigs and cows and grow corn and soybeans? What's that called? The guy drew a blank. He's starting to perspire, and we were all getting kind of worried. And finally, the registrar said, okay, he said, I'll give you a hint. He said, Old MacDonald had a, and the guy says, farm. So we were pretty relieved. He said, okay, now, here's the second part of the question. He said, how do you spell farm? And the guy just brightened up. He said, oh, that's easy. He said, E-I-E-I-O. Hopefully you haven't had to deal with those kinds of issues. But the other thing I thought I'd just mention to you real quickly is that sometimes coaching is more difficult than people think. You know, you read all the letters to the editor and all the commentary, and it seems pretty simple when you're sitting up there in the 50th row. But more to it than that. And so I thought I'd tell you a quick story about the last game that I ever coached. This was 1998, down in the Orange Bowl. We're playing Tennessee, and you have all these press conferences that you have to go to. The more important the game, the more press conferences there are. And the less you want to be there, you'd rather be practicing or doing something with your team. And so I found myself standing next to Philip Fulmer, the head coach at Tennessee, and we had players there with us, and pretty soon Philip struck up a conversation. He started bragging about his quarterback, Peyton Manning, to me, and he said, you know, Peyton's really smart, he's intelligent, he's innovative, he's creative, and he was going on, and apparently I wasn't looking very impressed, and he said, well, I'll prove it to you. So he called Peyton over, and he said, Peyton, I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to answer it. Peyton said, okay. He said, Peyton, who is your father's brother's nephew? Peyton thought a minute, and he said, well, that's me. Philip turned to me and said, what did I tell you? The guy's a genius. And I said, well, that's pretty good, but, you know, you don't want to lose face at these deals. You can lose a game right at the press conference. So I said, you know, our quarterback, Scott Frost, is really smart. He'll get that pretty easily, too. So I called Scott over, and I said, Scott, I'm going to ask you a question. Why don't you answer? He said, okay. And I said, Scott, who is your father's brother's nephew? And he thought a minute. He said, you know, that's kind of a tough question. He said, give me a minute. And I said, okay. So he kind of wandered off, and he saw our number two quarterback, Frankie Lennon, standing over in the corner. And he said, Frankie, he said, I need some help. He said, who's your father's brother's nephew? And Frankie thought a minute. He said, well, that's me. So Scott came back over and tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, hey, coach, he said, I got the answer. I said, what is it? He said, it's Frankie London. And I said, Scott, you knothead. He said, it isn't Frankie London, it's Peyton Manning. So I said, you get over and tell Philip Fulmer what the right answer is, and you should have seen how surprised Philip was when he got it. And so anyway, we won the game, and I think that whole episode was the key to victory. I was asked to speak to you a little bit about leadership today. And I suppose that everyone has some involvement with leadership at one time or another. If you're a parent, like it or not, you're in a leadership role. It may be Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, teacher in the classroom, you name it. Everyone has some leadership opportunities. And so I thought I would reflect with you on that topic for a little while. And essentially, most of us come into contact with one style of leadership. If you've had a summer job when you were 15, 16 years old, as you've worked with various employers, most of the time you've run into what we would call a transactional style of leadership. It's this for that. You know, if you work overtime, you get paid more. If you do a good job on this project, we'll consider you for a promotion. Oh, but by the way, if you're late, we may dock your pay. And if you're late again after that, we may have to let you go. So it's this for that. And we're all pretty well tuned in to that style of leadership. There's something else, another style. It's called transformational leadership. Many of you may have heard of it, may have read about it a little bit. It's somewhat synonymous with the term servant leadership. And the reason I want to maybe spend more time on that today is that research has shown that if you want to move a group from here to here, transformational leadership, if it's done right, will move that group further and faster than any other style of leadership. But it's also more difficult because it puts more responsibility on the leader. And so in transformational leadership, usually the leader is somewhat of a role model, usually someone who has traits, characteristics that are admired by those who follow. The leader is usually one who is willing to listen. In transactional leadership, you've all had bosses who do an awful lot more telling than listening. But in transformational leadership, it's important that you be willing to listen, to walk a mile in people's shoes. And that's something that's fairly uncommon. It's usually principle and value-centered. There are certain values that you will not transgress, and so you lay them out, core values. What are the things we believe in? What things, no matter what happens, we're not going to bend, we're not going to break? And early in my coaching career, some of you are old enough to remember, a lot of you aren't, fortunately, we lost to Oklahoma 5 straight years, which was not a healthy thing to do. And at that time, there was a fair amount of cheating going on in intercollegiate athletics. Not everybody, but I'd say probably a third. And it wasn't stuff like tattoos that you've read about. It was cars and clothes and cash. It was big stuff. And I remember at one point our coaches, a couple of them, came in and they said, you know, coach, if we can't beat them, maybe we better join them. And I remember at that time, said, well, you know, we've laid out certain things that we're going to stake our claim on, we're going to live by, and one of them is we're going to obey NCAA rules. And it may cost us our jobs. We may not make it, but at least we'll be able to walk out of here with our heads up. And so there's certain things that you will not transgress, not violate, if you're going to adopt that type of leadership. Another factor would be that of vision. Leadership really is about vision. It's about being able to anticipate the future, see over the horizon. Example of that would be currently, if you think about the newspaper industry, the conventional newspaper subscriber is someone like me who subscribes to a paper, reads it every morning or every evening, but people like me are dying out. And younger people, a lot of you here, don't probably do a lot with a traditional newspaper. You're on the internet, you're getting your information other ways. And so as time goes on, the question is, who's going to survive in the newspaper industry? Well, obviously those who have pretty good vision, can anticipate the future, whether it's moving online, whatever it may be, are going to survive. And the people who try to keep doing things the way they've always been done, just because they've always been done that way, probably aren't going to make it. So vision is part of it. And certainly being concerned about the well-being of followers. Sometimes the best mark of character and leadership is how you treat people who can do nothing for you in return. So how is the receptionist treated? How is the person who sweeps the floors at night? How is the most elementary job on the pay scale, how's that person treated? And so usually in transformational leadership, everybody's important. Everybody feels that as a person, they're of equal worth. It may not mean that their job is of equal importance, but still as people, they are valued and they are treated as though they are equals. And then lastly, if things go south in transformational leadership, instead of trying to find somebody to pin the blame on, transformational leader will take the hit. And so how many times have we seen in recent years where a company has gone down the tubes? Enron, Global Crossing, Tyco, you name them. And you read about somebody leaving the company with a $50 million golden parachute and no regard for the employees or the stockholders. They simply walk away with a pretty good situation and essentially don't take responsibility. That money that they're leaving with is coming out of the stockholders' pockets. It's coming out of the pockets of those who have labored for that company for many years, many of whom have had their pensions completely destroyed. And so transformational leader would probably not keep the money, or at least not all of it, and would try to make it right as much as they could. So I think you get a little bit of a snapshot. Now, let me relate that a little bit more to practical experience. So far, it's all been sort of theoretical and somewhat academic, about as academic as I can be anyway. And so probably the large part of my background was coaching. That's what I did for 36 years. That's probably what I can relate to best. I did spend 6 years in Washington. I hope all of you have forgiven me for that. But I was there, and I have been an athletic director now for 5 years, and probably with mixed results, hopefully more good than bad, but who knows. And again, we won't know for 2, 3, 4 years how that worked out. But anyway, I'll refer mostly to the coaching issue, because that's far enough in the past. I think I can look at it with some objectivity and maybe some certainty of what I'm saying. We had a culture in the athletic department over a period of 42 years that was somewhat consistent. Started with Bob Devaney in 1962. I arrived at the university in 1962 and was part of his staff as a graduate assistant early on. Worked for him as an assistant for 13 years. Became the head coach for 25 years. And then a guy that worked with me for 19 years rather, Frank Solich, was a coach for 6 years, so 42 years of time. And during that period of time, Nebraska was able to win 82% of its games, which, according to most Nebraskans, was far short of what we should have won. But if you look at it in a larger context, the next school in line during that 42-year period was Ohio State at 75%, and then Michigan at 74%, Penn State at 71%, and then Oklahoma, and so on. So that difference, for those of you who have studied statistics, realize that over 42 years, a 7-point spread is pretty significant. So there may have been some things that went on in that culture and in terms of that style that made a difference that might apply not just to football, but maybe to business, maybe to librarians. And so those are the things that I'll try to flesh out and talk to you about a little bit. There's a book that was written about 6 years ago where the author interviewed 28 players who had been in the program, 8 assistant coaches, been there for a long time, and try to get their take on it. Now, some of you read the book by Jack Welch on his leadership style. Jack came off sounding pretty good because he wrote the book, right? Nobody interviewed the employees. And so most books about leadership are written by somebody who can slant it just about any way they want. Well, this was a book that was written by the employees, so to speak. So I picked it up with some trepidation. It was called The Heart of a Husker, written by Mike Babcock. And probably didn't sell a whole lot of copies. But I was interested in the themes that came out. Wasn't sure what they would say. But the players seemed to almost unanimously mention the word honesty. They said, in many cases, they said Nebraska was the only place that didn't offer me something. Not always something illegal, but maybe it was playing time. You know, you're so good, you're going to come in and start for us as a freshman. You're so good, we're going to change our offense for you. We're going to build our whole team around you. It's pretty flattering when you're 17, but you realize that that's probably a lot of malarkey. But a lot of kids didn't feel that way. And so they said, you know, Nebraska only offered us an opportunity. They said, we wouldn't offer you a scholarship. We didn't think you were a good player. But you're going to have to prove what you can do. You're going to have to earn your spot. There's no guarantees. And for some reason, that resonated with a lot of them. They began to realize that there was a note of authenticity to what we were saying. And we lost some, but we probably lost the right ones. We lost the ones that were looking for a deal. And the right ones, for the most part, came. They were willing to lay it on the line, bite the bullet, and become great players. And, of course, the interesting thing about integrity and honesty is that where you have it, you have a high level of trust. And so if you've ever worked in an organization where there isn't a whole lot of honesty or integrity, you also realize there's a pretty low level of trust. And you cannot have a great family. You cannot have a great team. You cannot have a great company. You cannot have a great organization if there is not a high level of trust among those people who are involved. Stephen Covey Jr. wrote a book called The Speed of Trust. And he said when there's a high level of trust in an organization, people are free to move quickly, make decisions quickly. They're free to make a mistake and realize they still will be valued. And he said things happen a lot quicker. But where there's low levels of trust, everybody's looking over their shoulder, wondering who has a hidden agenda, what this decision is going to mean for me. And so trust is critical. And integrity is a big part of that. Second thing they mentioned that seemed to be very common among their opinions, they felt cared for. It's a simple thing, but they felt cared for. And so obviously on Saturday afternoon, the first-team player was going to be more important than the fourth-team player because the fourth-team player probably wasn't going to get on the field. If he did, it was going to be the last 3 or 4 minutes, and we were going to be up by 40 points. But they said, you know, as people, we felt cared for. We really felt that the coaches and people cared about us. They cared about our health. They cared about our education. They cared about our families. They cared about our well-being. And probably the best thing I did was every day after practice, I'd spend 20 minutes in the weight room. Our players lifted after practice, and so I'd go in there for 20 minutes. You can see by looking at me today that it didn't take. I'd go in there, and over that 20 minutes, I'd probably have a conversation with 4 or 5 different people, 4 or 5 different players. It was on their turf. I wasn't calling them into my office. And we didn't talk about football. We talked about their health, if they had an injury. We talked about their family. We talked about their high school football team. We talked about their brothers or sisters. And so I got to know them. And they felt that that they knew me, and they felt that they were cared for. And so we knew their names, and we knew the names of their parents, and we knew the names of their brothers and sisters, knew the name of their high school coach. And so that was important. And so applying that to your situation, somebody is sick that you work with, do you go out of your way to visit the hospital? Or if there's a death in the family, do you go over and spend some time with them? You know, particularly if there are people who really aren't high level in your organization, if they're at an entry level, you know, how are they treated? And so that's really critical for the health and the collegiality of an organization. The third thing they mentioned was that they felt it was a positive environment. Now, I don't know how many of you know much about coaching, but it's not always real positive. Sometimes it's pretty hardcore. Sometimes it's boot camp mentality. And so Lou Holtz called me one time. Lou was coaching down in Arkansas. Now he's on ESPN, and he has lots of answers. But there was a time when he was coaching, and he didn't feel he had all the answers. And so he asked if he could come up and visit us. And this was during the season. It was the first and the only time a coach has ever come to visit during the season. He had an open date. I said, sure, Lou, come on up. So he spent about 2 days, and he watched practice, and he sat in our meetings. And when he left, he said the one thing that really jumped out at him about what he saw was how positive our coaches were. And he thought that was remarkable. He had never been around that situation. I think it probably goes back to my background in educational psychology. It was deliberate. Because really, the best way to change human behavior is not to continually beat them down and tell them how bad they are, but rather is to catch them doing something right and praising or rewarding that behavior. Because then you get more of it, you know. And if you humiliate and if you denigrate and if you criticize continually, pretty soon people begin to throw up their defenses to protect their own sense of self-worth, and sometimes they get to where they can't even hear you. And so that went back to a professor I had, a guy named Don Clifton. Don worked in the ed psych department back in the 1960s, and he was struck by some studies that were done about the American soldiers in prisoner of war camps in Korea. 38% of those prisoners of war died. And yet there was no torture, there was no malnutrition. They were relatively well treated. But during their incarceration, these people were subject to informing on each other. If you would tell something about another one of your fellow soldiers that was negative, you would get candy, cigarettes, more food, whatever. If there was a letter from home that was negative, your wife was running off with a neighbor, you got that letter. If one of your children was sick, you got that letter. If your mortgage was going to be foreclosed, you got that letter. If there was something positive, you never got it, never saw the letter. And so you were even encouraged to inform on yourself, things that you had done in your past that you weren't proud of, that you were ashamed of. And if you told about those things, you're rewarded in some way. And so eventually, 38% of those soldiers at some point simply gave up. And they laid on their bunk and they turned their face to the wall, and it would be long before they wouldn't be around. And so Don postulated, he said, you know, if negativism was that powerful, then maybe the opposite would be true. Maybe if positive communication, positive reinforcement was used, it would have a real positive effect on performance. And so rather than studying rats running in a maze, and rather than studying abnormal psychology, he studied the best in human performance, the top producers in the insurance industry, the top athletes, the people who performed at high levels. And so he began to postulate the theory that in the workforce, positive comments in a healthy environment should outweigh negative by 3-1. And so, and then he said, in a close interpersonal relationship, like a personal friendship or a marriage, it ought to be 6-1. And they actually did studies where they watched couples, married couples, through a two-way mirror, and they recorded their conversation. And where positive and negative was about equal, or negative outweighed positive, they could pretty well predict that that couple would not stay together for a certain period of time. And so I found very quickly that if I go home tonight And Nancy has burned the meatloaf. And I very quickly better find five positive things to tell her. So I've gotten pretty good at that. The Department of Labor reported that 65% of workers claim that in the last year they have not received any positive commendation from their superior. That sounds hard to believe, but 65% report that. The number one reason why people leave their jobs is not because of pay, it's not because of benefits, but it's because they don't feel appreciated. So probably as an employer, as a leader, the least costly and the most effective thing that you can do is when somebody does something right is to praise it, point it out. And some people respond in different ways. You know, some people like things like this, and some of them like plaques. Some people just want a kind word. But the important thing is to recognize behavior that you're looking for and to go out of your way to point it out. And so we've been doing that in the athletic department, and it does certainly make a difference. A couple more things I'll mention. One is adversity. Adversity is certainly very common in athletics. You're going to have injuries. You're going to lose games you didn't think you were going to lose. But adversity is common to the human condition. It's part of the deal. And all of you experienced adversity, and undoubtedly you will experience more. And it seems like there are basically three ways that people respond when an adverse situation arises. One is to quit. You know, I've been passed over for promotion three times, so I still need my job. I need the paycheck, so I'm still going to show up, but I'm not going to try to really be superior at what I do. I'm just going to tread water. Or maybe you say, I'll just quit the job. And a player says, well, I've been out for football now for 3 years, and I've never started, so I'm going to quit the team. So you can quit. Second thing that you can do, which is very common in our society, is to blame somebody else. The reason I didn't get the promotion was my boss plays favorites. The reason I'm not starting on the football team is because the coach is just stupid. The reason I flunked the class was I had a really poor teacher. It wasn't my fault. So we point the finger. And in Washington, of course, they've taken that to a fine art. And then the third option is to look at adversity and see this as an opportunity. It's easy to say, you know, it's easy to stand up here and say, well, you know, you can look at a really adverse situation as being an opportunity. But let me give you an example. We lost to Oklahoma the first 5 years, which I mentioned to you earlier, that I was a head coach. I started out at age 35, and by age 39, 40, there were a fair number of folks in the state that thought probably I shouldn't be the coach anymore, and it was painful. And you say, well, you just lost five games, but we could win 10, and if we lost to Oklahoma, we had a bad year. And we had some of those years where we won 9 or we won 10, but it wasn't enough. And so it was kind of painful, but we looked at those films and we looked at those films and we looked at those films, and we realized that there was sort of a common denominator. Two or three times among those five losses, we had them on the ropes. It looked like we had them beat. And then their quarterback would scramble and he'd make a play, either with his feet by running for a first down or buying some time and throwing the ball. But they had speed and athleticism at quarterback. And we had guys that were drop back guys. They were good passers. They were NFL-type players, but they couldn't run a lick. And so we finally figured, well, maybe we can learn something from this, and maybe speed at quarterback is going to be important. And so we began to recruit speed at quarterback, and we became a little bit better. We started beating them our share, and then we started beating them a little bit more than our share. But whereas most people in Nebraska felt that Oklahoma was our enemy, and they were to be drugged down and beaten any way we could, we felt that Oklahoma was not our enemy. Oklahoma was our friend because we had to get to their level. We had to rise to that occasion. And so it was very instructive. And so failure, adversity, pain is unpleasant, but it's also very instructive if you take the right approach. And so probably the thing that will differentiate those in this room who do pretty well as opposed to those who maybe don't do very well with your lives, quite likely will have to do with how you deal with adversity. And if you're able to look at it as the third option, the option of seeing an opportunity when your funding is cut, seeing an opportunity when there's a tragedy in your family, it will make all the difference in the world. And there was a guy who lived about 150 years ago. This guy was engaged to be married. His fiance died, and he went into depression, and he couldn't get out of bed for 2 years. No medication. Finally recovered enough. He started a business. That failed. Applied to law school. Was rejected. Started another business. That failed. And like a lot of people who don't do well in business, he went into politics. And he lost his first election, his second, his third, his fourth, his fifth, his sixth, his seventh, and his eighth. And, of course, that was Abraham Lincoln. So if you think about it, he obviously didn't quit, and he obviously didn't blame somebody else. Through the pain and the adversity, he learned something and he got better, and he embraced adversity, and it made him better. And so anyway, that's something that you might think about a little bit. The couple more things. One was the issue of balance. You know, the Greeks about 4,000 years ago said that a truly educated person was one who had balance in his or her life. And they said there were really three dimensions of human experience. They said there was the physical dimension. And you remember they had the precursor of the Olympics, and they had athletics. And they said the second dimension was the intellectual dimension. And that's what we tend to think of as education. And they said, and they had mathematicians and scholars and philosophers. But they said, you know, that's not the whole deal. There's also the spiritual dimension. They said somebody who has grown and developed in all three areas is a truly educated person. And I thought about that because each year we had five, six, seven, eight guys drafted in the National Football League. And these guys had the American dream. If you watch advertising, the American dream is number one, to have money, right? So minimum salary, $300,000. Some of the top draft picks, multi-millions, Sue, probably $40 million first year. And so they had money. Secondly, is to have celebrity. You know, people wanted their autograph, wanted to hang around them, and they had that. Thirdly, is to have talent. They were probably in the upper one-tenth of 1% in terms of athletic ability. And fourthly, something I don't have anymore, some of you have, at age 22, they had youth. So they had the whole package, you know, at age 22, 23. You say, well, these guys are set. You know, they're going to live happily forever after. And then I was around long enough, I was seeing some of those guys come back out of the National Football League 3 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later. And I was seeing quite a few guys who were broken people. I was seeing people who were really struggling, some people who weren't doing very well. And I began to puzzle about that. I realized that some were one-dimensional. They knew how to block. They knew how to tackle. They knew where the weight room was. But when the blocking and the tackling was over, there was really nothing in their life that gave them any purpose, because that's what they were all about, was blocking and tackling and playing the game. And then you'd say, well, most of your guys had degrees, and they did. And they ought to do okay. But, you know, if your whole identity from the time you were 10 years old was that of being a great athlete, that's who you were, that's what you were known for. And then all of a sudden that was wiped out, a knee injury or somebody cut you from the team. That was equally devastating, even if you had a degree. And some of those guys were struggling. And then thirdly, I noticed that some guys, no matter what happened to them, would tend to weave their way through and somehow land on their feet. And these were people who almost universally had a spiritual dimension. Now, some of you may be religious people. Some of you may be agnostics. Spirituality can be defined as being willing to devote yourself to a cause that is more important than yourself, larger than yourself. So it doesn't necessarily mean a religious experience, but oftentimes it does. But I noticed that those people who had a strong spiritual dimension, because there was meaning and because there was purpose, no matter what happened to them, they would seem to do okay. And quite often it was people who had made a spiritual commitment to honor God with what they had been given. And so we felt that was important. We didn't preach, we didn't proselytize, we didn't tell anybody what they had to believe, but we certainly made spirituality something that was available. Because when you go out to play a game, and you're going to be stretched to your limits, you certainly need to engage your body, obviously. You need to engage your mind. But you also, at the highest levels, have to be engaged spiritually. Your heart has to be in it. You have to be totally into the thing. And so that was an important part of the chemistry and the glue. And so I'll end by mentioning a couple things that might be somewhat relevant to this topic. There's a book by Stephen Covey, and many of you may have read it, Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. And one of those habits kind of caught my attention because he said that habit was begin with the end in mind. He said you ought to really consider while your life is still vital, viable, you know, what's going to be important at the end. And that was driven home to me because Bob Devaney, the coach ahead of me, was laying on his deathbed, and he'd pulled all the tubes out. And Bob was kind of a feisty guy, and he'd had enough, and he just pulled the tubes out. So I went to see him, and I knew it'd be the last time I'd see him, and he knew it'd be the last time I'd see him. And he probably died a few hours later. But it's kind of interesting because during that last conversation, we didn't talk about trophies. We didn't talk about championships. We didn't talk about rings. We didn't talk about money that he'd made or awards. What was important at that point was family, and his family was with him. You know, it's pretty tough to die alone. And sometimes we forget about how important family is, particularly at the end. Secondly, relationships were important. People we knew, people we cared about, people who cared about us. And then thirdly, at least at that moment, where God was important to Bob. I asked him if he minded if I said a prayer, and he said no. And I saw a tear roll down his cheek, so I knew it was important to him. So the thing about it is that when you sit down, and what Covey suggests is that you write your obituary. Now, that's kind of a ghoulish thought, but he said you ought to write three of them, one from the standpoint of a family member, one from the standpoint of a friend, and one from the standpoint of a business associate. You ought to write those three and then read them and see what's in there. And when you do that, you're probably going to figure out pretty much what would be important to you at the end of your life. And then he said you ought to align your life in such a way that at the end, those things will be true. And so often I think we spend a lot of time and energy kind of chasing our tail or climbing the ladder of success. Sometimes the ladder is leaning against the wrong wall. And that's a sad thing when you're my age, to think about that and to see that all of the things that you've been doing have really not amounted to all that much. So I thought it was good advice that he gave. And that's one reason why we're so interested in Teammates, because Teammates is a mentoring program that we have invested a lot of time and energy in. And if you think about it, if you invest in the life of a young person, there's a ripple effect that goes on and on. In the scriptures, it says something about the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children to the third and the fourth generation. And we see that because dysfunction repeats itself from one generation to another. But also, investment, positive messages, positive influence is repeated from generation to generation to generation. And so in many ways, that's probably the best legacy that we can leave. Lots of you are teachers. Lots of you work with young people. And so you are investing in the lives of people who will in turn invest in the lives of other people. And so I think that's important to remember, and I think that's something that you can take great pride in. So enough from me. If anybody has a question, I'll be glad to field it. And as long as you don't ask me who's going to win on Saturday. Thank you for having me here today. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the keynote address from the Nebraska Library Association's 2012 Tri-Conference, held in cooperation with the Mountain Plains Library Association and the Nebraska School Librarians Association. The guest speaker has been Tom Osborne, former head football coach and retiring athletic director at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and former Republican congressman from Nebraska's 3rd District from 2000 to 2006, as well as with his wife Nancy, founders of the Teammates Mentoring Program, providing support and encouragement to school-aged youth to graduate from high school and pursue post-secondary education by working with a community mentor. The Teammates Mentoring Program currently provides a mentor for over 5,000 young people across Nebraska, Iowa, and California. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 18, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Michael Stratman, Executive Director of the Nebraska Library Association, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.